war is the ultimate instrument of coercion, and to use war to destroy democracy is a model that is, thanks to Putin, is very much alive and well in the world today. It's certainly a wake-up call, and the Ukrainians are showing that democracy is worth fighting for.
Hello, and a hearty welcome to Cambridge Forum. I'm Mary Stack, Executive Director of Cambridge Forum, and we have an ample agenda for you today. Can we resist the hijacking of democracy in America and beyond? In the past decade, we have witnessed the gradual and steady erosion of democratic values, a growing lack of respect for democratic institutions and process, both within the United States and beyond. Well, to help us make sense of the political quagmire in which we find ourselves, we have a meeting of three great minds today. John Shattuck and Sushma Raman are co-authors of a new book, Holding Together, Why Our Rights Are Under Siege and How to Reclaim Them for Everyone. And thirdly, our moderator today will be Archon Fung, Professor of Citizenship and Self-Government at the Harvard Kennedy School. And now I'm going to hand over to Archon.
Let's start with the invasion of Ukraine by Russia, which occurred just a little more, began a little more than 2 months ago. John, what do you think is at stake for democracy and human rights in Ukraine, but also in Europe and well beyond in this invasion and how it plays out?
This is a momentous time for human rights. I don't think there's any need to elaborate on that point. But I think what, in a sense, we don't look at enough is the origins of some of the crises that we face in the authoritarian violence. And that is very much what we see in the model that Putin is using to basically undermine and completely destroy, if he could, the very identity and national existence of the people of Ukraine. And of course, war is the ultimate instrument of coercion. And to use war to destroy democracy is a model that is, thanks to Putin, is very much alive and well, not well perhaps, but certainly alive in the world today. It's certainly a wake-up call for rather complacent Western democracies that I think have gotten used to the long period of peace. And the Ukrainians are showing that democracy is worth fighting for. I think what's at stake are a number of things. Above all, the rule of force, which Putin wants to impose on the world, versus the rule of law, which we are rather used to. And there's a quote by Thucydides, which I think says it all. The strong do what they can and the weak suffer what they must. That's effectively what the rule of force is all about. Sovereignty is, and national borders are very much at stake. This is a global threat. It's not simply a threat to democratic countries. The militarization of international relations, and above all, massive human rights crimes, and in this case, the crime of genocide, which is the destruction of the Ukrainian, or the attempted destruction of the Ukrainian national and cultural identity, which is really what Putin's stated aim is. Now, that's one model. There are two others that I'll just put forward very briefly. The second model, which is of an attack on democracy in Europe, is really the championed by Viktor Orban, who is the leading proponent and practitioner of what I would call the nonviolent hijacking of democracy and human rights. He's used a series of elections to take power and to hollow out and take over democratic institutions. He's become a model for other right-wing populist leaders who are trying to do the same thing. He's basically taken over the legislative, judicial, media, education, economic, financial, cultural, all the various institutions that go into making up pluralistic democracies. And he's done so by using what I would call the politics of fear, outsiders, migrants. He's attacked migrants and refugees for a long time, although he's accepting refugees now from Ukraine who happen to have Hungarian backgrounds. And this has been very influential in other countries, in Poland and France, where Marine Le Pen has taken heart from the victories of Viktor Orban, in Serbia, in Slovenia, in Italy, and also in the US, where Donald Trump and Tucker Carlson, as I think we've seen recently, have cited frequently Orban as a model of the kind of attack on democracy and human rights and the autocratic rule that he represents. Now, Putin has set back the Orban model slightly because Putin is a strong supporter and Orban was very close to Putin. And so what we've seen recently is the defeat of Marine Le Pen in France, the defeat of an Orban style prime minister in Slovenia, and the EU and UN, NATO rather, unity that's been shown in response to the attack on Ukraine. So that's the second model. The third model is what I would call the insurrectionist model. And this is the model that we have very much in play in the US today. It's championed, of course, by Trump, and it involves both nonviolence and to some degree violence, as we saw in the attack on the Capitol. So that's my overview.
How much do you think that this will, that this being the Russia's invasion of Ukraine, end up being a wake-up call? Because immediately prior to the invasion, or for several years prior to the invasion, you might think Europe and the United States had gotten a little bit sleepy with regard to democracy. Germany itself seemed very comfortable with all sorts of relationships with Russia, and the nature of the non-democratic nature of that regime, I think was no secret for anyone. We see the rise, as you point out rightly, of at least illiberal democracies, maybe even not democracies at all, in Hungary, and then populist, democratically questionable movements in France and Poland and many other places. We've maybe forgotten a little bit the value of liberal democracy, and to the extent that there can be any silver lining in a tragedy and a war as horrible as the invasion of Ukraine is, and it is very horrible, perhaps it is a wake-up call. But do you think it will end up being that? And how can we make it more that, so that we remember the value of democracy that has been a little bit hard for some of us to remember, I think, since the end of the Cold War?
Well, I think we don't have to go any further than to look at the heroic behavior and leadership of the Ukrainians on this subject. They have shown, indeed, that this wake-up call is necessary. Otherwise, if we all go to sleep, certainly the rather silent and insidious development of the Orban-style hijacking of democracy can occur, even if there's no direct attack from somebody like Putin. And I think what we've seen very specifically in the US recently is that it's maybe not perfect, but we've seen a development of some degree of bipartisan consensus that this is a fight for democracy and for the protection of the sovereignty and the human rights of the people of Ukraine that a very polarized country like the United States can agree on. And the same has been true across Europe. We've certainly seen in the elections in France, as I said, and also in Slovenia, but also in the new interest that Sweden and Finland are showing in joining the NATO alliance. And all of that, I think, is a stirring of interest in democratic values. It certainly, the complacency that we felt as a result, I think, of the long period of peace, and also a high degree of willingness to just be interested in material goods and well-being, all of that cut against democratic interests. So we'll see. We'll see how far this goes.
And I want to put a question on the table that that we'll answer in a little bit. But this one is for everyone in the audience to ponder. And I raise it because I've been pondering it myself. I was at a meeting in which many people were talking about the state of American democracy. And a journalist from Texas said, well, I came to the meeting to try to understand how to explain the importance of American democracy to Jane and Joe at Stop and Shop, who seem to care more about inflation and gas prices and the employment and economic situation. And so that led me to a thought experiment, which I want to pose to the panel and to the audience, and we'll revisit. But the thought experiment is this, is how do you explain, imagine that January 6th, that the insurrection had been successful. And right now, when we're doing this, this discussion on the Cambridge Forum, Donald J. Trump is president. I think that actually not that much would be materially different in the lives of Jane and Joe at Stop and Shop on this Tuesday evening. So I'm asking you how you would explain to Jane and Joe at Stop and Shop why they should care that the 2020 election on this hypothetical wasn't successful, that the person who didn't get the most electoral college votes ends up being president. Why should they care as opposed to the price of gas or their inability to get health care and child care? So let me put that, we'll revisit that when we talk about American democracy in the second part of the segment. So think about that question. I want to raise immigration and the refugee crisis that has been occasioned. We've been in a series of refugee crises, at least since the beginning of the Forever Wars, but there's a new burst, obviously, with the Russian invasion of Ukraine. The invasion has displaced some 11 million Ukrainians so far, most of them internal, but 5 million have fled to other countries. And Sushma and John, as you point out in your book, one of the central responsibilities of other countries is to assure that the human rights of these refugees are respected and protected. Sushma, how do you think we, broadly speaking, the countries of Europe and North America, are doing in regard with this latest incredible refugee crisis?
So Arkan, as you mentioned, 11 million people have been displaced, at least 11 million people. And we will anticipate that many more will be displaced in the weeks and months to come. I'll flag that initially, as we think about displacement, we should also think about people who are internally displaced, who often may be invisible, undercounted, and not always available, able to seek international protection. So that is something to bear in mind as well. In terms of people who've been displaced within other countries, you know, there is a notion that somehow the West has often had to bear the burden of refugees, whether we think of people in Syria or, you know, other countries. But the reality is most refugees who are displaced tend to be within the region. They are either displaced within their countries or they are living in the region. And in this situation, we of course see many people being displaced in Poland and other neighboring countries. So the question becomes, what is the role of the United States? And the reality is the refugee program has really been dismantled under the former president and the administration. And while there were definitely ebbs and flows with the program and a need for improvement, it has been decimated. And so this new program to help 100,000 people is really insufficient. And we really need to think of ways to revitalize the entire program as opposed to helping just a few people who perhaps were already privileged because they had family members here or they have some amount of resources, which would inadvertently affect the most disadvantaged people.
Yeah, the 100,000 number is interesting. When Biden announced that number, I think the leader of Ireland said, yeah, we're taking in 100,000 Ukrainian refugees as well. So it's quite incredible, being a much, obviously much smaller country. You know, one of the worries that I've heard is that at the same time, the incredible outpouring of support from Poland, from Estonia, from many countries around Ukraine, trying to welcome in Germany, not least welcoming refugees at the governmental level, at the civic and community level. Some of the criticisms that I've heard are that, well, that's wonderful, but we saw quite a different reaction when the refugees were coming from Syria and Iraq and the Middle East. What, do you think that that's a fair criticism? And how do you reconcile that disparity, if you think such a disparity exists?
Well, I think that, our refugee policies often reflect the other kind of policies and values and attitudes. And we see this in the United States as well, with the deep anti-Black bias that exists in the ways in which, for example, Haitians or people from Africa are treated versus people from Cuba, let's say, or folks from Europe. So this really is something that is global. And so, yes, we need to tackle it in our refugee policies, but we also need to tackle it through other mechanisms such as civic education, ensuring racial equity in our domestic laws and policies.
So in a hopeful moment, I pointed the disparity to a friend of mine. I said, well, maybe one of the lasting effects will be the extension of our sympathies, is that we'll look at the recognition of the need of these Ukraine, the extreme need of these Ukrainian refugees. And then in the future, when refugees have a different ethnic or religious background, we'll be more generous. That is, people in Europe and North America, and there'll be an extension of universalism. And this person was not as optimistic as I am. He said, no chance. What do you think? Do you think that that will be a possibility?
I don't think so. I think
Oh, no.
Well, maybe I should say we're hopeful, because part of the theme of this book and my prior book with Bill Schultz, The Coming Good Society, was more hopeful. But I also look at the arc of migration over the past few decades and the ebbs and flows, and the ways in which perhaps people from Central America are kept in camps while they are waiting processing, or they're held in detention. And of course, the treatment of Haitians on the border has really been horrific in many ways, including sort of sending people back to Haiti and the treatment of people by Border Patrol. So I do worry that we're not necessarily going to develop greater empathy, but it would be nice to hope for that.
Yeah.
We are in at the very early stages of what I think is going to be a huge global migration crisis.
Yes.
Contributed to not only by things like the war in Ukraine and all the poverty and violence that people are fleeing to come try to come to the United States, but also by climate change and by all of the huge elements of global insecurity that we see. And so I would say of all the future human rights problems, this is going to be near the top of the list. And I think countries are going to have to come together in a much more effective way than they have. We need new refugee law. We need a much better understanding among countries about how to allocate responsibilities. And all of that, of course, is politically difficult. And therefore, I'm not optimistic that this can be done overnight. But I think you're right to point to this as one of the biggest issues that we're facing in the future in the human rights dimension.
I completely agree with John. You know, more people are on the move today than at any time since the Second World War. And the reasons for movement are far more complicated than the ways in which we define refugees 70 plus years ago. So it is not just fear of a religious persecution. It is a combination of factors, poverty, climate-induced displacement, you know, rising sea levels, you know, and even sometimes conflict that is generated because of desertification, gang violence, for example, or, you know, extrajudicial killings that occur. And so this is a very broad landscape. And so we really need to be thinking about what are our global commitments, not just to people of our nation state, but really across the globe. And many of these problems, particularly around climate, but also economic inequity, were generated by many who were from prosperous countries. So I do think it is owed to us to think about these issues in this more cosmopolitan frame, as you suggest, Arkan. I'd like to just briefly touch on the question you raised earlier, which was very provocative, that two people at Stop and Shop might feel that this may not be materially different. And I would argue differently. So if I was, let's say, Jose and Maria, I may be afraid to go to Stop and Shop because I might be afraid that I will be deported, right? If I were African-American, I might feel afraid that the people who perpetrated racial violence on January 6th are operating with impunity So I do think that even if our bank balance may not have changed in that sense of material difference, there may be a difference in the way we see ourselves and our place in this country.
Excellent, excellent point. I guess I really agree that the immigration flows and people flows across borders will only increase for all of the reasons, John and Sushma, that you said. And unless we can figure out internationally how to deal with that situation in a more sensible way that protects rights, then democracy in these countries is going to be in a lot of trouble, because it is the nativist responses to the people flows that in the United States, in France, in Germany with the AfD, in England, that has put an enormous amount of pressure on democracy, because we haven't developed the muscles in these societies to figure out how to deal with the much higher rates of immigration and flows inward. I wanted to return to the question of Russia and Europe and Europe's interests. What I want to ask is, in the long arc, do you think this will be good or bad for peace and democracy in Europe? Because much more quickly than many of us had anticipated, Germany turned on a dime, Finland and maybe Sweden will join our kind of pro-NATO. The countries of Europe are coalescing around NATO and a rearmed alliance, because they're aware of the possibility of Russian and other kinds of military invasion. So the optimistic lens is that Europe is now awakened to the importance and the challenge of maintaining peace on the continent. A more pessimistic future as well, whatever the outcome of the war in 6 months or 1 year's time, all of these countries are going to be rearmed. And they have very, very different ideologies and beliefs and politics. And that turns Europe into a much more dangerous place than just 2 months ago.
Well, I think there are risks, to be sure, in the policies that are being pursued right now. But in balance, I think they are policies that will help defend democracy, resist against the kind of coercion and violent coercion that Putin represents. And I think you're not seeing a mass rearming of the societies in Europe. However, we're living in an extremely dangerous world. And I think arms for some degree of deterrence, a high degree of deterrence, are necessary. And arms in a coalition are very different from arms that are under kind of nationalist, even xenophobic interest that might be the case in the event that some of these populist right-wing governments were to come to power in addition to Orban. So I think in balance, it's a good development. I do think there are current short-term dangers. I think that the danger of escalation of the war is very much there. I think it's unlikely that the West is going to pursue escalation, but it obviously, by arming Ukraine, it does invite the potential for that, including obviously the danger of the use of nuclear tactical weapons. I think the question of a military solution over a diplomatic solution, which is at the moment seeming to be the predominant approach, is a little problematic. However, it's entirely up to the Ukrainians to determine when and how they might want to solve this war diplomatically. And I think finally, the long-term question of who's going to be in charge, particularly in the United States, in the event that Biden turns out to be a one-term president, and what happens after that, and what, so there is a great deal of uncertainty about the future of this alliance, even though I think its current direction is entirely appropriate and is actually defending democracy.
So I would reply to that question with a slightly different answer, which is that I think we need to think about the role of civil society and social movements within countries in Europe, as well as regional and kind of, more global movements. Because the reality is, if we're talking about defending democracy, building resistance, building voices for change, then we really have to think about local leaders and the ways in which to strengthen the infrastructure for civil society in many countries where civil society is currently under attack. If we think of Hungary, if we think of Russia, and it's not just human rights groups. Of course, human rights groups are greatly at risk, but it's a broad swath of civil society institutions, including academic organizations. And so I think that is really, really important as we think about responses to have long-term capacity building for ensuring democracy.
Absolutely. And I think right now, so much of the Ukraine-Russia story is a story of, is the military story. And that's where the reporting is. That's where a bunch of the social media is. In retrospect, as time passes, I think more of the story will be a civil society story, to see the protests in these towns that are occupied by pretty brutal Russian forces. And, you know, ordinary people in the town yelling at these soldiers is just an incredible mark of bravery. And I think that we'll be paying more attention to that as in the fullness of time, I think. And then how does the situation in Ukraine leave the idea of international human rights and international war crimes? In one way, we have seen war crimes the likes of which we haven't seen in Europe in quite some time, in a long time. And already there are investigations going on. But on the other hand, I know that the United States is not signatory to the Rome Accords or the ICC, and I believe Russia is not either. So does the current situation point to a reality in which those international accords and norms are just too slow and impotent, and the parties to them, the people that you need to be parties to them, just simply won't be? Or will it strengthen those international institutions going forward?
I think the problem today is that with the UN in gridlock because of Russia having a seat on the Security Council and unwilling to authorize anything like a new tribunal, it's going to take UN reform. That's almost an oxymoron, I think, and whoever would have thought that UN could reform itself given its political makeup. But that's what it's going to take in order to get these issues of accountability and justice addressed. However, I want to go at a different level, and particularly building on what Sushma earlier said, which I completely agree with, the issues of civil society and the opportunities for civil society levels of accountability to be developed and the record being created and the extraordinary work that the Ukrainians themselves are doing right now in compiling this information is very important. And I think the record, it's important in an era of disinformation and lying that an accurate account of the atrocities and even genocide, which I said before, that are being committed in Ukraine is going to be done. And that will happen. I believe that is happening. Whether they can lead to some kind of trials at the international criminal level is another question.
Okay, so I'd like to thank today's guests, John Shattuck, Sushma Raman, and Archon Fung for such a good job. Cambridge Forum is made possible through the generosity of Dorothy and Herbert Better, the Lowell Institute, the Cambridge Community Foundation, and you. If you'd like to donate or sign up to our members list, visit our website, www.cambridgeforum.org. Thank you all for taking part.